It was not every night that he came down the spiral staircase to fetch her. On many nights there was the rumble of carriage wheels on the cobbled streets below Louisa's window. She blew out her candle and peeped through the curtains to watch Meneer van Ritter's guests arriving for another banquet or fashionable soiree. Long after they had left, she lay awake, hoping to hear his footsteps on the staircase. But she was usually disappointed. For weeks or even months at a time he was gone, sailing on one of his fine ships to places with strange and evocative names. While he was gone, she was restless and bored. She found that she was even impatient with Gertruda and unhappy with herself. When he came back, his presence filled the great house, and even the other servants were enlivened and excited by it. Suddenly, all the waiting and pining were as if they had never happened, as she heard him descending the staircase, and leapt from her bed to meet him as he stepped through the secret door in the panelling. After that, he devised a signal to summon her to his chamber, so that he no longer had to come down to fetch her. At dinner time, he would send a footman to deliver a red rose to Gertruda. None of the servants who delivered the bloom thought it odd. They all knew that Meneer had an inexplicable affection for his ugly, slow-witted daughter, but on those nights the door at the top of the spiral staircase was unlocked, and when Louisa stepped through, he was waiting for her. These meetings were never the same. Every time he invented some new game for them to act out. He made her dress in fantastic costumes, play the role of milkmaid, stable boy, or princess. Sometimes he made her wear masks, the heads of demons and wild animals. On other evenings they would study the pictures in the green book and then enact the scenes they depicted. The first time he showed her the picture of the girl lying under the boy and his shaft buried in her to the hilt. She did not believe it was possible. But he was gentle, patient, and considerate, so that when it happened there was little pain, and only a few drops of her virgin blood on the sheets of the wide bed. Afterwards she felt a great sense of accomplishment, and when she was alone she studied her lower body with awe. It amazed her that the parts she had been taught were unclean and sinful could be the seat of such delights. She was convinced now that there was nothing more that he could teach her. She believed that she had been able to pleasure him and herself in every conceivable way. But she was wrong. He went away on one of his seemingly interminable voyages, this time to a place called St. Petersburg in Russia, to visit the court of Pyotr Alexeyevich, whom other men called Peter the Great, and to expand his interests in the trade in precious furs. When he returned, Louisa was in a fever of excitement, and this time she did not have long to wait for his summons. That evening a footman delivered a single red rose to Gertruda while Louisa was cutting up her roasted chicken. "Why are you so happy, Louisa?" Gertruda demanded as she danced around the bedroom. "Because I love you, Gertie, and I love everybody in the world," Louisa sang. Gertruda clapped her hands. "And I love you too, Louisa. Now it's time for your bed, and here is a cup of hot milk to make you sleep tight." That evening, when Louisa stepped through the secret doorway into Meneer van Ritter's bedchamber, she stopped dead in astonishment. This was a new game, and she was at once confused and frightened. This was too real, too terrifying. Meneer van Ritter's head was concealed with a tight-fitting black leather hood, with round cut-out eye-holes and a crude gash for a mouth. He wore a black leather apron and shiny black boots that reached to the top of his thighs. His arms were folded across his chest, and his hands were covered with black gloves. She could barely tear her gaze away from him to look at the sinister structure that stood in the centre of the floor. It was identical to the flogging tripod on which miscreants received public punishment in the square outside the law courts. However, in place of the usual chains, silk ropes dangled from the top of the tripod. She smiled at him with trembling lips, but he stared back at her impassively through the eye-holes in the black hood. She wanted to run, but he seemed to anticipate her intentions. He strode to the door and locked it. Then he placed the key in the front pocket of his apron. Her legs gave way under her, and she sank to the floor. "I am sorry," she whispered. Please don't hurt me. I've been sentenced for the sin of harlotry to 20 strokes of the whip. His voice was stern and harsh. Please let me go. I don't want to play this game. This is no game. He came to her, and though she pleaded with him for mercy, he lifted her and led her to the tripod. He tied her hands high above her head with the silken ropes, and she peered back at him over her shoulder, with her long yellow hair hanging over her face. What are you going to do to me? He went to the table against the far wall, and with his back turned to her, picked up something. Then, with theatrical slowness, he turned back with the whip in his hand. She whimpered and tried to free herself from the silken bonds that pinioned her wrists, twisting and turning as she hung on the tripod. He came to her and placed one finger into the opening of her nightdress and ripped it down to the hem. He stripped away the tatters, and she was naked. He came to stand in front of her, and she saw a huge bulge under his leather apron, evidence of his arousal. 20 strokes, he repeated in the cold, hard voice of a stranger, and you will count each one as it falls. Do you understand, you wanton little whore? She winced at the word. Nobody had ever called her that before. I did not know I was doing wrong. I thought I was pleasing you. He cut the whip through the air, and the lash hissed close to her face. Then he went behind her, and she closed her eyes and tensed every muscle in her back. But still the pain of the stroke defied her belief, and she shrieked aloud. Count! He ordered, and through white quivering lips she obeyed. One! She screamed. It went on and on without pity or respite until she fainted. He held a small green bottle under her nose, and the pungent fumes revived her. Then it started again. Count! He ordered. At last she was able to whisper, 20. And he laid the whip back on the table. He was loosening the strings of his leather apron as he came back to her. She hung on the silk ropes, unable to lift her head or support herself. Her back, her buttocks, and the tops of her legs felt as though they were on fire. He came up behind her, and she felt his hands on her lower body, drawing her red throbbing buttocks apart. Then there was a pain more dreadful than any that had gone before it. She was being impaled in the most unnatural way, ripped apart. Agony tore through her bowels, and she found fresh strength to scream and scream again. At last he cut her down from the tripod, wrapped her in a blanket, and carried her down the staircase. Without another word, he left her sobbing on the bed. In the morning, when she tottered to the cubicle and sat on the commode, she found that she was still bleeding. 7 days later, she had still not healed completely, and another red rose was delivered to Gertruda. Trembling and weeping quietly, she climbed the staircase to answer his summons. When she entered his chamber, the tripod stood in the middle of the floor, and once again he wore the hood and apron of the executioner. It took months for her to gather her courage. But at last she went to Elise and told her how Mynheer was treating her. She lifted her dress and turned to show the welts and stripes across her back. Then she bent over and showed her the torn, festering opening. "Cover yourself, you shameless strumpet!" Elise shouted, and slapped her cheek. "How dare you make up filthy lies about such a great man and good man? I shall have to report you to Mynheer for this, but in the meantime I will tell Stolz to lock you in the wine cellar." For 2 days, Louisa crouched on the stone floor in a dark corner of the cellar. The agony in her lower belly was a fire that threatened to consume her very soul. On the third day, a sergeant and 3 men of the city watch came to fetch her. As they led her up the stairs to the kitchen yard, she looked for Gertruda, Elise, or Stolz. But there was no sign of them or any of the other servants. "Thank you for coming to rescue me," she told the sergeant. "I could not have borne it another day." He gave her an odd, enigmatic glance. "We searched your room and found the jewellery you had stolen," he said. "What terrible ingratitude to a gentleman who treated you so kindly! We shall see what the magistrate has to say to you." The magistrate was suffering from the effects of the previous evening's overindulgence. He had been one of 50 dinner guests at Huis Brabant, whose cellars and table were famous throughout the Low Countries. Kern van Ritters was an old friend, and the magistrate glowered at the young female prisoner arraigned before him. Kern had spoken to him about this hussy after last night's dinner, while they puffed on their cheroots and finished off a bottle of fine old cognac. He listened impatiently as the sergeant of the watch gave evidence against her and laid before the magistrate the package of stolen jewellery that they had found in her room. "Prisoner is to be transported to the penal colony in Batavia for life," the magistrate ordered. Het Gelukkige Mu was lying in the harbour almost ready to sail. They marched Louisa from the courtroom directly to the docks. At the top of the gangplank she was met by the head jailer. He entered her name in the register, then two of his men locked leg irons on her ankles and shoved her down the hatchway to the gun deck.